This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to the Evening Edition with Kelvin Yee. 51 years ago, in the afternoon of 17 June 1968, a group of security personnel from the police field force were making their way from Krung in Perak to the southern Thailand town Betong, when they were ambushed by a group of communist guerrillas. 17 personnel were killed, and that marked the start of the communist insurgency in 1968, 8 years after the end of the Malayan emergency. The second round of armed conflict lasted for 21 years and 5 months and ended only after the Communist Party of Malaya, or the CPM, agreed to the signing of the Hat Yai Peace Accord with the Malaysian government. That was on the 2nd of December 1989, exactly 30 years ago today. To commemorate the event, Aiman Rashad and I recently spoke to Dato' Paul Keong, a retired superintendent of police who was a special branch officer during the insurgency. For 6 years, he infiltrated the communist movement by going undercover as a courier. His stories demonstrate the bravery of an officer who risked his life many times to weaken the insurgency. For his efforts, he was awarded the Seri Palawan Gagah Perkasa, or the Grand Knight of Valor Medal, the highest federal award in the country. Here's a conversation with him, held at the PDRM Museum at Tasik Perdana. Could I first have you introduce yourself?
Okay. My name is Paul Keong, a retired superintendent of police in 1998, February. And I've served 31 years in the Royal Malaysian Police Force. Okay. And I joined the police force in 1967. Yeah. Actually, that is Royal Malaysian Police Force 67. But prior to that, I went and joined the Singapore Police Force in 1964. When I joined Singapore Police Force, Singapore was part and parcel of Malaysia. Yeah. After which, I came back to Malaysia after the separation. Singapore, I left Malaysia. I still continue my service. Continue my service in Johor Bahru. And then that's where I landed up. 8 years serving there, and 15 years in Perak State, and 8 years in headquarters Bukit Aman in Wilayah.
Throughout that period, you know, when did you join the special branch and why did you decide to get involved in the effort to counter the threat from communists?
Now, after joining the police force in 1964 in Singapore, in the Singapore police, I was not involved in any special branch work. I was only doing general duties. Later, after separation, when I came back to Malaysia, then I was taken back to the Royal Malaysian Police, but I was attached to the special branch. Now, after my service in Johor Bahru, I was promoted on the 1st of January 1976 to the inspector rank. There was a selection process. They interviewed me and others to find out whether suitability, where I should be posted, which branch I should be posted. So I think eventually the result came out that I'm selected to serve in the special branch, Royal Malaysian Police Force. And I was posted to police headquarters Ipoh, Perak. And that's where I got involved very directly and very deeply in fighting the militant and subversive communist elements in Perak State.
So you were tasked with infiltrating the communists in the jungle. Can you talk to us about what you did during that time?
Coming to this part of infiltration in the Communist Party of Malaya, we call it CPM, Communist Party of Malaya, there are two phases that I want to clarify here on the CPM. Now, the CPM consists of two wings. One wing is the underground wing. They call it the Malaysian National Liberation Front. Yeah? The other wing is the militant wing, the Communist Terrorist Organization wing. Yeah? So the underground wing is MNLF. The other militant wing, we call it the MNLA, Malaysian National Liberation Army. Yeah? So one is in the jungle, one is in the town. So what happened was, when the Communist Party of Malaya was very active and at its height of activities in Perak in 1973-74, the subversive elements in the town area was very active. Active in the sense of logistic support to the militant unit, the MNLA, in the jungle. Not only being giving logistic support, but also giving intelligence. And at the same time, they did a lot of recruitment. So to us is, we have to take drastic action to cut off the logistic support from the subversive element in the town area by not giving them any logistic supplies to the militant unit. So in this aspect, we have to infiltrate to find out more about these subversive cells or these subversive CPM groups working in the town area, right? So there are two ways of infiltration. One is you can recruit member units from the underground, compromise them, and ask them to cooperate with us. Then put them back into the underground cell without their senior cadre knowing it. That's one way. The other way is you yourself take part and join one of the secret cells of the Communist Party of Malaya. So here we recruited quite a number of them, put them back as double agent, and eventually the feedback was very positive. The intel was good. First-class intel we had, and we knew what they're going to do, what action they're going to take along with the militant unit in the jungle. That is the infiltration I'm talking about.
More on our conversation with Dr. Paul Keong after these messages. Stay tuned with us. You're listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to the Evening Edition, and now a continuation of our special feature with former Special Branch Officer Dato Paul Keong.
So we heard that you captured 43 insurgents without bloodshed. How was that done?
Oh, it's a long story. This operation, can I call it Operation Catfish? Yeah? Operation Catfish was, I think, one of the most successful operation mounted by the police special branch against the Communist Party of Malaya. That happened in 1981 until 1986. It is roughly about 6 years. Yeah. We infiltrated the militant unit of the Communist Party of Malaya. That was the 5th Assault Unit, which was very active in Perak during that time. Yeah. And they had engaged our armed forces in many, many firefights in the jungle. And they are quite experienced fighters, and they are quite seasoned fighters, and they caused a lot of casualties on our security forces. Now, this 5th Assault Unit of the CPM consists of about 50 or 60 of them. Yeah, they came down from the Thai border back in 1968, crossing the Thai-Malaysian border, came down to Greek, Kuro, and through Sungai Siput, down to Ipoh, the Kinta Valley. Okay? So I think Perak was a very active state, and being an active state, we cannot allow them to take foothold in Perak state. We have to destroy this unit, the militant unit. Our strategy was simple but effective. by 1st, we will drive the unit, 5th Assault Unit, away from the jungle fringe, deeper into the jungle, by deploying regiment-sized, brigade-sized security forces from the armed forces, the army, as well as from the police field force. At that time, there was a police field force unit attached to the PDRM. So by driving them higher ground, we believe and we know that there won't be enough food supply for them. Okay? And they will not be able to make contact with the underground unit who are supporting them through logistic support. And by driving them to higher ground, we knew that there is less game as you go higher in the mountains. Yeah, game like monkeys, or wild boars, birds. They don't really go to high ground.
So they couldn't hunt for food.
So they suffer hunger. Okay? So which army in the world or which soldier can fight a war on a hungry stomach? Very simple logic. Then at the same time, while driving them up to higher ground, Special Branch mounted another operation in the town area. Yeah. By arresting more underground supporters of the Communist Party of Malaya. Yeah? We pick them up, and then at the same time, we convert them and put them back to where they stay, knowing fully well that it's a matter of time sooner or later when we release the pressure on the militant unit in the jungle by withdrawing our troops, they will come back to the jungle fringe and town areas and make contact with the supporters. So on that basis, we build up our intelligence network and we are ready for it. And once we are ready, we pull out the armed forces. And when we withdraw the pressure, then they knew that, oh, the forces are withdrawn. Now we are so hungry, we are so desperate, we have to come down to make contact with the underground or those who are supporters of the communist cause to get food supply. So our planning was perfect and true to our strategic tactics. They came down, they were so hungry, they were so desperate, they want to get food. So they were a bit of careless, should I say. Sometimes they make wrong move. They went and talk to people, ask for support for wrong people. Sometimes they contact the right people, but the right people are with us. Okay? So reports of intelligence reports come back to us that, oh yes, last night or two nights ago, communist terrorists came to my house, asked for this, asked to buy this. The food list is this. This food list I have. Okay? So from there, we know which unit are coming down, who was contacted, what are the food they wish to buy. Okay? And from this pressure and release mere strategy, as I mentioned just now, we also know and we expected many of them being pressured through hunger, many will desert the militant units and many will surrender through hardship. And also true enough, it did happen. It did happen. Husband and wife, communist terrorists in the 5th Assault Unit surrendered, or rather deserted the main unit. And another two couples, husband and wife, deserted because they cannot stand hardship and hunger. And after the desertion, three of them surrendered to the authorities. And with this surrender and desertion from the 5th Assault Unit, we managed to get the cooperation, to compromise them and convert them. Eventually, three others surrendered. 6 + 3 = 9 we have in our hands on this project Catfish. Now, from these 9, what we did was, after compromising them, to get their support, we want to go back to the jungle with them, to meet up with this, with the other groups who are still hostile, have not surrendered yet. There are other splinter units scattered in Perak, which have not been compromised. And these splinter units didn't know that desertion, surrender, and capture has taken place by the special branch. So with 9 others whom we already compromised, I will go back with them, back to the own playground, make contact with the other hostile group, whom they didn't know that they have come into our hands. But again, it was a risky and very high-risk, dangerous mission. Because when you go back into the jungle with the 9 of them, nothing will stop them from changing their mind. If they change their mind and did not want to cooperate anymore, they will turn around. And then when you are in the jungle, of course, they will assassinate you. So these are the risks that we have to take. And from the 9, we snowball. We snowball in capturing the other 3 groups, which eventually we capture all of them, of 43, which is the 5th assault unit of the Communist Party of Malaya, without firing a shot. Okay. It's a long story, but of course it was a drawn-out period of 6 years of infiltration work.
From 6 years, what were some of the incidents that stood out in your memory?
The 6 years incident that really put me in a very frightening situation was when I took a group of them into the jungle, back into their own playground, that is the members of the field assault unit, to capture another hostile unit coming down from Kelantan. I was nearly betrayed. The group I went in with, there were about 16 of them, who gave the assurance through word of mouth that they are willing to cooperate with Special Branch. But when I was with them in the jungle, waiting for the hostile unit from Kelantan to come down to meet up with us, 2 members of my unit came during the night to inform me that one of the leaders of my group is going to betray us, rather betray this operation. So they came in the dead of night, woke me up and told me, please don't send so-and-so out to meet the hostile group from Kelantan. He said he's going to tell the Kelantan unit that we have been compromised by the special branch and there's a police special branch officer with us. Then later, 2 hours later, deep in the night, another female communist terrorist in my group also came, woke me up and whispered to me that this same person is going to betray us. So with these 2 intel that I received, and then next morning, I decided not to send that person who's going to betray us to meet up with the Kelantan group. I held him back and I replaced him with another communist terrorist city to meet up with a hostile group from Kelantan. So that was a frightening experience. It was very, very fortunate that I was tipped off. If not for that, I think either when I'm meeting up with them, I would be killed in the crossfire, or they would abandon the project, or they would ambush us along the way. Yeah. So it was a good move by the communist terrorists who were converted. And I think that saved my life, or saved the operation. That is one of the event that I can never forget. So much as I told myself that I thought I knew the communist terrorists very well, I thought I can read their mind, I can read their heart, but somehow or other, there wasn't 100%, there was a bit of slip up that I cannot see their mind, I cannot see their heart. One of them wanted to betray us. That is the frightening experience I had.
You use words like frightening, risky, and the assumption is always when you engage in these sorts of operations, you kind of have to be quite brave. You kind of have to have the absence of fear, but I'm sensing there was quite a lot of fear in so many of these circumstances you were in.
Now, coming to the word fear, now I think everybody fear death, right? Everybody fear death. Now, it's because of fear of not returning to your loved ones, not returning to your family. It's because of this element of fear that you somehow or other marshal up all your witty experience, your knowledge on the communist terrorist mind. You marshal up all this knowledge and experience in the jungle, and you put up your best plan into action. It's because of the fear factor that you don't return to your wife or don't return to your family. So you cannot make a mistake in this our operation, in this kind of our work, because it is not a game of sports, you know. Lee Chong Wei can go and play for badminton and cannot get a gold cup. The moment I come back, the minister said, Chong Wei, don't worry, train again. Next year we go again and try again. In our field of work, there's no such thing as second chance. You don't try again. You lose, you make a mistake, you screw it up, you're dead. And if you're dead, you can find your body, like my mind. You cannot recover your body. What's going to happen? The risk that you think is high, but if you need to go, then it's one of those things. The police force can replace you tomorrow if you are dead today. Your family cannot replace you. So you must come back at all costs. So because of the fear, you put the best plan into operation and you have confidence that that plan will work and you will be successful and you come back alive.
We are featuring our conversation with Dr. Paul Keong, former member of the special branch who fought the communists during the insurgency. After the news, he tells us of a harrowing experience he had as an undercover agent. Keep it here on The Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Be firmly motivated. BFM 89.9.
You're on The Evening Edition with Kelvin Yee. Today, we've been commemorating the 30th anniversary of the Hat Yai Peace Agreement by featuring a conversation that Ayman and I had recently with Dr. Paul Keong about his experience infiltrating the communist movement as a special branch officer. Here's the continuation of our interview.
Can you tell us about your experience going undercover among the communists?
My experience are many, but anyway, I give you one example of a special operation I went into. We captured 5 communist terrorists during the night. So during that process of the conversion, in part we call it interrogation, among the 5, the city leader there did not want to respond to me. Now, can you imagine for 4 days interrogating him, he just refused to converse with you. You give him food, you eat. You give him drinks, he will drink. But he will not talk to you. Now, this is the worst scenario where an interrogator would face. When he doesn't respond and communicate with you, you cannot read his heart and mind. 4 days, he didn't want to talk to me. On the 5th day, in the afternoon, I remember about 2:30, he turned around and told me, all right, what do you want me to do? Now, we knew all along at that time that we have to convert him and get his cooperation within 6 days. Because on the 6th day, he has to pass a roll slip, a letter, to a hostile unit in the jungle. Failing which, that hostile unit in the jungle would definitely smell something is not right. They would suspect that this group has been compromised or have been arrested or captured. So on the 5th day, he said, I'm willing to cooperate. So we still got one more day to play. So now, with him for 4.5 days, 5 days, he's not talking to you. Now suddenly he turned around and said, yes, I'm willing to work with you. Now, how will you feel? How will you gauge him? How will you assess him? Can you trust him? So, without showing any any surprise or any taken aback sort of feeling, I said, okay, in that case, I'll work it out for you. You will deliver a letter to the unit. So during the meeting, I briefed that he's willing to cooperate. And then the meeting was not too happy, the committee. Then he said, Paul, can you trust him? Then I answered back. I said, sir, I think we don't have a choice. I said, I'm prepared to take the risk. Okay? Because you don't take a risk, I think our ongoing project or catfish, I think will come to a stop, to an end. So, okay. The meeting agreed, reluctantly agreed. So I prepared my groundwork, wrote up a small letter, put into a capsule, waterproof it, give it to him to deliver. So next day, on the sixth day, exactly on time, I ferry him in my car as a co-pilot. And in my car, I drove him all along into the jungle fringe in the Sungai Siput area. So we had the rehearsal of 50 minutes. You go in, meet up with the group, deliver the letter. 15 minutes, you must come out, and I'll ferry you back. Come back to the car. So all set. I changed my car number plate, and I did all the necessary things. At night, I ferry him to the jungle fringe. All along the journey, he did not say a word to me. I dropped him off and left him to go alone to meet the 16 hostile group. He went in. It was dead night. No, there was no moon, I remember. I was wearing a luminous watch. And I timed myself 50 minutes. So he went in. I waited. After reversing my car, put the front headlight in front, switch off the engine, stop. Now, during the meeting, the hi-fi meeting, you call it hi-fi meeting, when you brief them that it's a very high risk that he may betray you, the meeting did not discuss what would you do if he betray you. Because the meeting knows if he betray you, you are just dead. And there's no backup force which is nearby for you, help you. By inserting any backup force, you alert the communist informers living in the jungle areas or the town area that there are some movement of security forces. Then the information may go back to this hostile group and it will not take place. The meeting will not take place, right? So we cannot afford to have a backup unit. So he went in, I waited, 15 minutes up, I don't see him coming out. Now, even though the hi-fi meeting did not discuss how we are going to, what action you're going to take if he betray you, I have my own emergency plan. Should he betray me? My emergency plan was, I would not want to go alone. So I think I'd be able to take down two at least with me, and perhaps it's fast enough, I may take three. You are going to go, that's it. If the chips are on the table, your chips are down, then we fight it out. Okay. So that was my plan. Okay. Anyway, my pistol already cocked, ready, one in the chamber, one bullet in the chamber, ready for action. So waited 15 minutes, nothing happened. 20 minutes, nothing happened. 25 minutes passed. So again, the fear of having to take life away crosses my mind, which I want to avoid at all costs. 30 minutes, still nothing happened. I said, that's it. I told myself, I think this is the end of the story. Yeah. So get ready. I got out of the car, opened my door. I used the door as a buffer in case there's a firefight. The crossfire, the bullets, may, the door may hold some bullets. Okay? Take fire, take some of the fire. And during the crossfire, hopefully that I'll bring at least two or three of them down. Okay. So 35 minutes, still nothing. Then in my mind, it started to come into play that if ever the communist group want to come and capture me alive. If I were in the position as the leader in that group, what would I do? I told myself, very simple. I got 13 of us. I come out, come to the car, break into two groups, surround you, capture you. You cannot run at night. Where are you going to run? So a lot of things crossed my mind then. Not so much of fear, no. The much of feeling regretful that this is the end of the road, that I have to take life. I have to bring down people. I have to kill. Yeah. So I said, okay, that's it. Let's face it. I got out of my car, stand near the door, waited. And then 5 minutes later, then suddenly I saw shadows coming out, coming towards the car, to the back of the car. As they reached the car, the boot area, I was shocked. I found that they opened up left and right flank. Three coming on the right, four on the left. So I said, this is exactly what I thought they would do. I said, wow, great, now time for action. Again, not so much a fear of dying, it's a fear of when do I start shooting? I must have the cue. Now, whether that person who delivered the letter has really betrayed me or not, I don't know. I don't know. So my heart was thumping. Adrenaline was running up and down the head. I was waiting when to shoot. Now, it's up to you now. You decide. Your life is at stake. When you shoot, wrong decision, innocent people get killed, and later you found out that actually he didn't betray you. It was something else that delayed him. Then the whole project will be blown far apart. And in the crossfire, they may kill you. But you spoil the project, you blow the project. So I was holding back until the last minute to see now when I can be sure that he has betrayed me. Then as he draw nearer and nearer, I make eye contact with the Korea communist terrorist. I made eye contact with him. He looked at me. And the word he said to me, come, let's go. Oh, I feel so relieved that I did not pull the trigger. So I did not show any sign. I was quite composed at that moment of time. He opened the door. He went in. I went in, closed the door, sat in. I started my car. I don't show any panic. Slowly, I drove off. There was a sigh of relief. But again, I told you, coming, he did not speak to me. Going back, he did not want to speak to me. So eventually, we reached our base. I put him back. Then I briefed the meeting. The meeting was happy that he was successful. I said, I've not got the reason why there was the delay, but now I'm going to ask him. So I went back. I called him out. I asked him. I was not upset. I was not angry. I was curious. Okay? I said, why you did not abide to our agreement that is 15 minutes? Why you took so long to return? He said, it's not that I don't want to come out at the appointed time of 15 minutes. It is because when I went and contact with the city group of 13 of them, two of them were from my kampung. We have not seen each other for many years. So we had a long exchange of conversation. Okay? So that's why I cannot withdraw myself too fast. They will suspect me. Why this fellow coming? Suddenly he wants to run away so fast. So in order to avoid any suspicion falling on me that I have been compromised, I stick on and continue with the question and answers from the two villagers who are living as my neighbors before. So I was quite happy with that. His answer was very legitimate, and he was quite witty on that sense. I have to thank him for that, and that saved the day and saved the operation. I think that is one of the the high-risk operation I took, which I think would not happen if you dare not prepare to take the risk, you see.
More on our conversation with former Special Branch Officer Dr. Paul Keong after these messages. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bole for Malaysia. Ha. BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is the Evening Edition with Kelvin. Here's the rest of our interview with former Special Branch Officer Dato Paul Keong about his experiences during the communist insurgency.
You know, you talk a lot about the head. And whenever you address it, you point to your head as well. That a lot of it is about the brain, the mind, and appealing to them. And I guess that's why you also took this approach where you don't take lives, because they're more useful to you. They bring information, they become much more useful much later. Why was that belief in the mind so strong?
To me, communist ideology boils down to indoctrination. Yeah. So when it goes into the mind, the person who disperses such indoctrination is to convince you that what he's dispersing to you is the correct way, a correct policy of certain principles in society. So to counter this sort of indoctrination, you must have another team of people who are very well versed with what is communist doctrine all about. So we are fortunate that in Special Branch, you have a lot of experienced people. Deep knowledge on communism, the doctrine aspect, the policy of the governing of the society, because they were one of them before. They came to us during those early days, during the British time, and they have make a lot of analysis themselves during that period of time when they recuperate with us. In Special Branch, and to be able to counter the present set of people who are being indoctrinated with such doctrine. Now, once they are convinced and they agree that they have been misguided, then they will come around very slowly, yeah? And they will exchange their thoughts, their feelings, and then deeper into it, there's some sort of a bonding arises then between the interrogator and the enemy. And then the trust element will come in. When they trust each other, then that's where we can work together as a team. So the trust must come voluntarily from his heart and from his mind. From day one, you start to talk to him, your integrity is at stake. You must be honest. Don't promise whatever you cannot abide to. Don't promise him heaven and hell. Don't ever lie to him. Okay? So it is a matter of trust now. Okay, I'll bring back to one incident where I emphasize now, as I said, so much on the word trust. I was going in and out with this city leader of the 5th Assault Unit to capture hostile group in the jungle. A few times, alone. One day he came to me after when we settled down to big base camp. He said, "I wanted to ask you many times why you're so brave to come in with us in a group deep back into the jungle, our playground. You're not afraid that we may betray you?" I said, "Look, if I am prepared to come in with you alone, unescorted, with no backup unit, do you really think that I'm afraid to die? You can kill me, yes. But by coming in with you, I'm prepared for full sacrifice. Just like you, fighting the government of the day, you're prepared for full sacrifice. But if I'm killed, you betray me, I can only give you one promise. That is, if I die, security forces will come and hunt you relentlessly until they capture you. And I can promise you, once they capture you, they'll prosecute you in court, they'll hang you. You know what is armed revolution? Taking up arms, fighting the government of the day? We are a sovereign country, a sovereign state. You're taking arms to fight the country. That is treason, and we hang. That I can promise you. I told him, I said, I'm not afraid of anything else. You think about it. That's why I talk about trust. I trusted you. You must trust me. Simple as that, I said.
Have you met any of the communist members after the insurgency?
Now, coming to this question is a very interesting question that I wish to emphasize. Since capturing them, so many of them alive, I'm very happy. When I go and visit them, we are still very good friends. We meet over tea. I take them out for dinner. They spend me dinner today. Tomorrow is on them. Today is on me. I'm writing my memoir. Sometimes I forget certain events of the day during those operational period. I will call him up. Hey, can we meet? Why? No, I cannot remember certain dates and certain time. Who was with us? Can we discuss? He said, come over. So we meet them and we talk. So enemy is those days. Once the mindset is changed, they're the best of friends. Only lately, I came back from Johor Bahru. I met one of them, husband and wife, Siti. The children are doing very well. You just imagine, he makes so much money. He has got a big house. And of course, he's so much rich now. And he take bus in the jacuzzi. I'm still using a pail to take bus in my bathroom. So just imagine it. So I'm happy for him. Yeah, that and they are very happy that I've given them a second chance. I've given a second chance in life. Yeah, I even brought the city leader, yeah, to this museum. And he's happy that the war has ended. Yeah, government has given them a second chance. Their family thanked me very much for it. I said, please don't thank me. You thank the government of the day that the government is prepared to give you a second chance, provided you all are cooperative, repentant, and come back to society and contribute to nation building. The government is very grateful to you all on their part too.
What does peace mean to you? And when you think about peace, who do you think of?
When I think of peace, I think of the people. The people who can go about spending their hours outdoor, indoor, don't have to apply for curfew passes. You know about curfew passes? Certain areas those days that you want to go in there, you must have a curfew pass while you go in. And all that. The police must sign and all that. Okay? So peace is, those days to me, a treasure is so much. You know how we lived those days in the 1970s, 80s? How I led my life? Going back without the same time. Going back, driving my car with two pistols, one underneath the car, one pistol strapped to your hand, to your side. You're like our late Khoo Cheong Kong, the chief police officer of Perak. He was ambushed and assassinated in Perak, going back for lunch. Head of police state, no, in Perak, he was assassinated. One more, then our IGP was assassinated in Jalan Chulan area. There's no peace. Yeah? You live in fear. No? Yeah? To me, peace is you don't live in fear anymore. People are no more in fear to mix around with one another. Yeah. So to me, peace is a big thing. To me, I treasure so much. Freedom is something that you won't treasure it until you lose it.
Do you have a message for the Malaysian public on this special occasion?
Well, on this special occasion, I would advise the Malaysian society, please do not take our peace and security for granted. You see? Treasure the peace that we have today and make peace with one another, love each other. And I would advise the people, whether politicians or laymen, to refrain from bringing up sensitive issues, which is not would not benefit the country and would not benefit the people as a nation. And I believe that our politicians are mature enough to continue to serve the people and serve the nation. And I hope that people in general, society, will give the strongest support to the present government of the day.
That was Dato' Paul Keong, retired superintendent of police who served in the special branch during the communist insurgency. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can look up the podcast on Spotify, on our website, or on our BFM app. We continue our commemoration of the 30th anniversary of the Hat Yai Peace Agreement after the 7pm news, so stay tuned with us on Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.